I know, I should probably be drinking water. Actually, coffee does funny things to the voice. And I
don't know, it doesn't matter. It sounds natural. And we you know, the clinking of cups, cups, etc. It's all part of the general atmosphere.
Oh, yes. Gosh, I remember. There was once a breakfast show on Radio Leicester where they got a number of us. And they said, you know, make sure we can tell that you're having breakfast. So everybody enthusiastically clinked. And you can barely hear any of us through clink, clink, crash, thud.
Hello and welcome to the Beyond podcast. I'm your host, Robert Crichton, General Overseer of Beyond, which specialises in creating full-cast audio adaptations of drama from before 1642, as well as providing background and other production resources. You can support our work and get a say into what we produce by becoming a patron today. Go to patreon.com/beyondshakespeare. Anyway. Today, I am delighted to be joined by Lois Potter, who has written extensively over the years on drama, edited many plays, and has a specific interest in Robin Hood, which leads us to today's chat about Look About You. Lois will be familiar to many of our YouTube viewers as a regular reader and contributor to our sessions, which we continue to pinch ourselves over. This really is a discussion chat, in a personal chat with Lois over coffee. So it's much more relaxed than some of our other online discussions. And I've left it actually relatively au naturel to let you sit back, relax, you know, join us as we sip our coffee and munch on biscuits and listen to our discussion about the play Look About You, which really is rather fab. You can listen to a reading of Look About You on our YouTube channel, as we've done an initial exploring session, and I'm sure we will return to it in a much more extensive way in the future. But till then, get yourself a cup of coffee and join us as we have a chat.
So yes, what have you been writing about?
Well, my immortal works include a lot of stuff on drama, but I did actually start with a book on Milton, and then because of that, I kept getting asked to write about Milton and 17th century poetry, and I think I finally asked somebody who was editing a series of plays, could I do something on drama? At that time, I thought I'd be editing a play, but he was actually, this was T.W. Craik, and he had just taken over this thing called The Rebel's History of Drama in English. So he asked me to write something for that, and then he asked me to edit a couple of the volumes in that. And then some of the work I was doing in that got me very interested in the period where they always say there is no theater, that is the Civil War and Commonwealth. Mm. And so I wrote a book on that period. It ended up being not just on drama, but on other literature, and it was sort of tied together by the notion of codes, in fact. So it was called Secret Rites and Secret Writing. Mm. And that was really the first period in which you started getting codes and code breakers, and that side of it was interesting. But I was also interested in the kind of code they call literary, where you just learn to interpret things a certain way. And it's a very good period for that, because there was a man named George Thompson who collected everything that came out and put the date on it that he bought it, so that you could actually read things and, you know, have a sense of what was coming out in a particular week. Mm. And if you do that and then read some of the pamphlet literature, which seems impenetrable when you first read it or just plain stupid, you discover that it's actually very, very clever. I mean, it's referring to very specific events, which everybody would know at the time, but which have been completely lost, of course, to history, unless you go back and, you know, read the same stuff that I read. So I just got interested in the whole notion of codes and secrecy, and why people are obsessed with it, and in fact, why people always want to know the one thing they think you don't want them to know. I mean, it doesn't much matter what it is, you know. Mm. I mean, people could get up on the housetops and shout about their sex lives, and nobody would be interested. But if it turned out that they're really the thing they were really ashamed of was their passion for crisps or something, you know, then everybody would want to know that.
Yeah, I mean, it is a shame that the official cutoff point for what we do is 1642, because, you know, I had to put a cutoff point in somewhere. But you know what mission creep's like. I think my personal interest sort of dips slightly, once you're past Elizabeth and you're into the Jacobean, because there are some lovely individual plays, but I think my interest in sort of the narrative of what's going on dips a bit then.
Yeah.
But it does then peak up again for the interregnum, because there's a lot of stuff going on there that's really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And prefiguring what then comes with the Restoration and all of that. So it is a shame, but you know, I've got to draw a line in the sand somewhere.
Yes, right.
We've got enough plays on our books as it is. But you never know. You never know if the patrons demand it, maybe we will we will dip into that.
No, it is rather intriguing. I've been asked to edit everything that is collaborative for some reason. People seem to think I have a passion for collaborative literature. So I was then asked to edit Eastward Ho for the collection of Marston.
Mm.
On top of that, I've got this other interest in Robin Hood, and I've written a number of articles on him. I've also I've got two essay collections on Robin Hood, both of which came out with the University of Delaware Press when I was in Delaware. And we also had a conference on Robin Hood there, because I discovered that for Americans writing on Robin Hood, that was actually the area that they imagined as Sherwood Forest. Howard Pyle, who did probably one of the best Robin Hood things, The Merry Adventures of Robin Hood, lived in that area, and he also had a sort of school of artists, which included in Wyeth, who also did a series of illustrations to Robin Hood.
Mm.
And there is actually a museum of book illustration in the Brandywine Valley and the Brandywine River Museum. And I realize, I mean, you can visit Howard Pyle's studio still, and you can go along the Brandywine River, which is very beautiful. It has a lot of forests, and that clearly was for them Sherwood Forest. I mean, Howard Pyle, in fact, I think only visited England at the very end of his life because he preferred to imagine it. So, you know, it made sense to have a Robin Hood conference, and in fact, it was about images of Robin Hood, which is what the book we published afterwards was about, how people pictured him or imagine Maid Marian, loads of stuff about Maid Marian now because of the whole sort of feminist, you know, revision.
Mm.
So anyway, that's sort of one another side, I suppose, of what I do.
What were the name of the Robin Hood books that you have written?
One's called Playing Robin Hood, and the other is called Images of Robin Hood.
Mm-hmm.
Playing Robin Hood is based on the idea that you know, when people say, I said this in something I wrote for the Red Not Dead season when they were doing the Robin Hood plays, and they asked me to write something for the program, and I said people are always asking, was there a real Robin Hood? And the answer is yes, there were hundreds. Because people tended to take that name when they decided to go out and be bandits. You know, it was I think people still do that sort of thing, you know, sign themselves Jesse James or something, you know, when they hand a note to the bank teller. It was just interesting that that people were playing the part. So the playing Robin Hood was very much about performance of Robin Hood in other cultures, but kind of taking on the Robin Hood image, and plays about Robin Hood.
Mm.
Yes,
because we've covered pretty much all the Robin Hood material, sans going back to actual ballads and the other material. So yeah, maybe we should segue into Robin Hood generally. I mean, you've looked at Robin Hood overall. I mean, Look About You, the play that we will be discussing in more detail anon, is more tangentially Robin Hood-y in the sense that you could say it's a prequel to Robin Hood. Mm-hmm. There is a Robin Hood does feature, but he doesn't do Robin Hood-y things. Yeah. Other characters do the Robin Hood-y things.
Yeah.
But we have a whole wealth of material. Some of it dramatic, some of it not. So yeah, where does this sort of fit into the Robin Hood universe?
Yes. and
how it evolves. You know, where does Robin Hood all start?
Yeah, well, that would be a really good question. I mean, it does seem to be a name that outlaws were taking at a fairly early point. And there's been more and more evidence found of, you know, pushing back the early date. But the earliest ballads that we have, I think, are, well, we don't know when they originated, but of course they were only recorded in the late 15th, early 16th century. And then the Robin Hood plays are from the 16th century. And the ballads really have a kind of dramatic element anyway. I mean, they quite often begin with something like "Lith and listen, gentlemen," you know. So clearly somebody is pitching it to an audience.
Yeah.
And when they end, you know, "Christ have mercy on his soul that died on the rood." I don't know if everybody is going to cross themselves at that point, but
there's always a question at the end of playtext of that kind as well. When the, when it says "Amen," you know, does everybody do that? Is that, or is that just a literary convention of just putting it at the end? Because we've touched on the podcast itself, we've looked at the shorter sort of folk Robin Hoodie kind of plays. We've looked at the sort of the very scrappy manuscript of the Robin Hood and the Sheriff, which is more a sort of outline for where the fights go, with some occasional lines of dialogue, which is very scrappy, as well as the more formed Robin Hood and the Friar and Robin Hood and the Potter, which are good fun.
Yeah.
In fact, we looked at them the other year in a virtual conference symposium thing where we had a little read-through of those.
Yeah.
That's not available, but our audio versions are available on the podcast, as I do my little plug there. The links are all in the show description. You can go to them if you so wish. So we've got a universe, but how fixed is Robin Hood? I mean, as, beyond as an idea, how many of the sort of story elements are fixed early on, or is he just a name? And how do all the bits fall together over time, if that's a fair question?
Yeah.
That's a big question to ask, actually.
Well, in the early ones, he really is an outlaw, and there seem to be other outlaws that are named fairly early. I mean, Robin Hood and the Monk, which seems to be the earliest ballad, has Little John already. Yes, please. Thanks.
As we pour more coffee.
Yes, thank you. That's great. And I think much. But what's interesting is that Maid Marian, whom everybody takes to be, you know, absolutely essential in the story, doesn't actually appear until the 16th century.
Mm.
And the basic outline of the story really is due to Anthony Munday.
Mm.
I mean, nobody before then had linked Robin Hood with Richard and John. For one thing, they were often put in a completely different period. I mean, one of the little jest of Robin Hood, which is published right at the beginning of the 16th century, has the king coming to the greenwood and meeting Robin Hood and coming in disguise and being impressed and so on. But he's referred to as Edward, our comely king.
Mm.
They may be thinking of Edward IV, who would have been the most recent Edward, and who was remembered actually fairly enthusiastically. But it was Munday who got the idea of linking it with Richard. He got this from, I think, Scottish historians who I think did put Robin Hood in the reign of Richard, but didn't sort of link the notion of. I think that one Scottish historian talks about him being a nobleman who got into debt and finally had to go into the woods and be an outlaw. But it doesn't. It doesn't suggest that he's outlawed by treachery, and it doesn't link him with Richard's absence and return. And that's what Munday did, really, and it's what most of the later retellings do, is suggest that he's outlawed unfairly, and that when Richard leaves the country and Prince John is in charge, everything is incredibly corrupt, and Robin Hood has to live in the forest, and then when Richard comes back, there's a big reconciliation. And then they... Maid Marian, you know, originally she's a character, as far as I can see, in the Morris dance. She's played by a man. She's kind of a joke. And somehow or other, the notion of Marian comes into the Robin Hood story to provide the love interest. I suppose, you know, sooner or later, everybody's going to want a love interest.
Yes. I mean, and you know, talking about Munday, so Munday wrote... is it presumed? I forget off the top of my head. Is Munday and possibly others? It's a complicated text or series of texts, because we have the downfall of Robin Hood and we have the death of Robin Hood, and they're slightly untidy texts. So the downfall is pretty much your traditional Robin Hood story.
Mm-hmm.
Which then sort of peters out towards the end. And at the end, you get this sort of bridge to the next play, and maybe the play's got recast or reformulated so that the sequel works, and then the death starts with the death of Robin Hood and then goes off in a totally different direction to follow Marian.
Yes.
So they're a very complicated sort of as texts, but Munday certainly brings a lot of spirit to them. The downfall of Robin Hood, should we say Robin Hood Part 1, is your traditional Robin Hood story.
Yeah.
I mean, it's you know, you would absolutely recognise it today, and actually, if you just quietly took out the coda at the end suggesting the sequel, that is exactly what you get. And it's a really fun play, and really, really enjoyable. Whereas the death is a bit of a downer.
Mm. Yeah, it certainly is. And it really is a separate story most of the time.
Mm.
But in fact, I think that they then went back and rewrote bits of part one to make Marion fit with Matilda Fitzwater, who is part of a whole other tradition.
Yes, there is a confusion in the text as to her name. It constantly sips back and forth, so it does look like someone's played around with that to try and make it all fit together.
Yeah. It's hard to imagine that they would ever have done part two, really, or the death, the way it's written. Mm. I mean, I don't know what they were trying to do with that.
I have to say, looking at that as a text, I might do the death bit as a weird separate studio piece to go with the other.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't connect it with either play, actually. It feels so detachable. Mm. I might do a play about Marion / Matilda. Mm. That feels right, but it doesn't quite connect.
No, I mean, the other thing would be, because the whole Marion play is part of really of a Prince John or King John sequence, and as someone's pointed out, John is really the linking character in all those plays, and he is kind of fun. I mean, he's just awful. I mean, he's silly and laughable in some of them, and then becomes really vicious, and then as I recall, at the end of the death, he's saying things like, "I will be better than I have been." And you'd think, well, that wouldn't be difficult. But
yes, promises, promises.
Yes, yeah.
And I think that's a good route in to look about you, because we have this play, which we could call a prequel to Robin Hood. Robin Hood does feature, or Robert Hood, is in the text. He's there as a relatively important linking character, but he's not a major key character throughout the text. But the focus is much more on other characters. And the family dynamic of the King, Henry the Second, and his various sons. And John, in this, of course, has massive anger management issues.
Oh, yes.
He is quite delightfully angry all the way through.
Yes, and he's obviously meant to be ridiculous. People keep commenting on him all the time.
Yeah, it's but well, because we've done our first look read through on the YouTube channel, you can go and watch / listen to that if you so wish. It is, I think we did four sessions in the end.
Yes, we did.
So there's about 8 hours
yeah.
on Look About You if you so wish, or you can skip through it to the bits that you find interesting. But yeah, there are so many different angles to Look About You. Mm. So you've got that family dynamic of John and Richard and the king and his wife and the poisonings and the murders and it's a bit bamboozling for us, actually. I think that's the element of the because we don't know historically much about Henry II.
No,
in popular culture.
Well, I think very few people know about that weird episode where he crowned his son, which was a huge mistake, in his own lifetime. As the historians say, this is the only time it was done, and it was never done again because it was such a disaster. But, at that period, there wasn't necessarily the view that if king is dead, long live the king. You could have the king is alive, but long live the king anyway, the new king.
Mm. I have to say it was an element of this the story that I didn't remember at all. Mm. I'm sure I thought I knew my kings quite well, and I went, "Oh, hang on, this is very left field."
Because
it starts with the worst sort of Christmas gathering ever, and everybody's at each other's throats, and it's delightfully fun.
Yeah, it's very enjoyable. Yeah, I mean, I noticed that the dramatist leaves Geoffrey out of it. I mean, there were four sons, and I think he just couldn't figure out how to characterize four of them. And maybe Geoffrey was off doing something else, but historically, though that the historical thing wouldn't have bothered him much, I suspect.
No.
But he knew what to do with Richard and John, and then the young king is rather a weird character, and he certainly didn't do what he does in the play, go off into a religious life at the end and suddenly have this amazing conversion.
Yes, because the spoilers ahead, by the way, we will be telling you what happens. And the end of the play is rather I think it's fabulous. There was some disagreement
in
the room.
Yeah.
I think it's great. So spoilers ahead, we will be discussing that.
Right.
Because most of the play, I mean, we said the play opens with John and Richard. Yeah. It doesn't actually. It starts with Robert on a mission and visit a hermit.
Oh yes.
And of course, the play opens with a hermit who isn't actually the hermit. The hermit is dead.
Yes.
sort of assisted suicide. It's a really tricky question. So there's a character called Skink, who is very despicable.
His name says it all.
It does. Who has sort of killed the hermit, who was apparently already dying anyway.
Yeah, so he says.
Mercy killing, according to Skink.
Yeah.
So Skink is one of our central disguising protagonists. Mm. And this play, as well as touching on Robin Hood, and we'll perhaps circle back to Robin Hood later, is much more about just the fun you can have with people playing dress-up.
Yeah.
So it's a disguising play, and of course that fits into a lot of plays around the time this play is being produced, 1599-ish. That's off the top of my head. I don't have it on my notes, actually. There are a lot of plays playing around with disguise and the fun you can have with disguise. Disguising plays and how this fits in.
I mean, this seems to me the apotheosis of disguises, but they may have been started off by Chapman's Blind Beggar of Alexandria. But that's really just one character who keeps disguising himself. And then I think The Blind Beggar of Bethnal Green, which is later, is probably an attempt to cash in on the success of this one. I mean, I can sort of see that some of the same characters are turning up in it under different names, or the same actors are playing the roles that they played in this.
Mm.
But this play, I mean, it's clearly just making fun of the whole notion that disguise is impenetrable and that any sort of signifying gesture or characteristic will immediately fool everybody. Because, I mean, some of the disguises are a costume, most of them are, but then there is a character who stammers, and the minute anybody decides to imitate him and stammer, everybody just falls in for this. There's an amazing bit where somebody imitates him to the stammerer's own father and is still not recognized.
So the stammerer is Red Cap. A messenger who's is the problematic element for a modern production. Though we sort of decided in the room that he just needs to be constantly out of breath because he's a messenger who's always running about, and that sort of might be a way round that problem.
It's got to be something very distinctive that can be imitated easily.
But the text overall is really interested in this, just how many variations on a theme of someone wanders in disguise to somebody else and that confusion. Can you get away with? Because every single scene is basically exactly the same, but just slightly different. And it somehow succeeds in making that work, and it shouldn't, actually. Yeah. We should be bored of it by halfway through, but actually it keeps delighting us and keeps us ticking over.
Yeah. I think one reason is probably that there is a fair amount of suspense. I mean, there's Skink, who in the first court scene is recognized to be he's a murderer. I mean, he has actually killed the king's mistress, Rosamond. This, of course, is legendary, and he's a fictitious character. And he's done this at the urging of the queen and probably been paid by her. And I think all of Henry II's sons are behind this because they were annoyed about this mistress, too. And their mother, Eleanor of Aquitaine, is really sort of demonized, and she's been in prison for this. I mean, the king imprisoned her, but then his son deposed him. Or somehow they've got her out of prison eventually. Skink is really a bad man, but he doesn't really come across that way. He comes across as sort of the Joker in a way. And then there's also Gloucester, who is also not historical. I mean, there was a historical illegitimate son, but he was dead before this play began. he's apparently a, and they seem, he seems to be an illegitimate half-brother of the, of all these awful princes in the royal family. But he also seems to be something of a war hero. I mean, we discover later on he's fought all over the place, and he's apparently been the life and soul of the army, which certainly none of the others have. And he seems to have been a crusader, in fact, like Richard. But he gets into trouble in this court scene, because when he discovers that this new upstart king is going to give all his lands to Skink, he's furious, and he hits Skink, whereupon, hitting somebody in a court, in a royal court, is of course an offence, but it's hardly an offence punishable the way they want to punish it. I mean, later on we discover that they would actually punish him by cutting off his right hand. And they say that is the punishment for this. It's hard to believe. Anyway, so he gets put in the tower. Then Skink, at this point, is still safe, but as things get more and more dodgy with the row in the royal family. I think the Henry's sons tell him, you better get out of here. So he escapes, but not for long. He's picked up by the watch, and it's not really clear why, but anyway, they take him to the tower.
I think it's to do with his disguise, because he's disguised himself as Red Cap.
Yeah.
So to make himself more safe, he actually ends up having to go to where he's less safe. He sort of gets trapped. He sort of traps himself into it.
Yes, he does. It's still odd, because I couldn't really, you know, looking at it again, I still couldn't figure out why they were sending Red Cap back to the tower when he was being sent on a message somewhere else. But it seemed as if the watchmen were being terribly officious. I think they say something, I'm going to show that we're really on top of our job.
There are a couple of bits in the text where some of the plotting feels like it's something's happened to the text.
Yeah.
So there might be a better reason in there somewhere that's got lost or over time.
Well, actually, I mean, one problem is that the text, they think it was printed from the author's manuscript, and the author clearly had really weird spelling and punctuation. So it's an unusually difficult text. I think it's one reason the play isn't better known, in fact. In fact, I think any company that did it might be well advised to make its own text and really spend quite a bit of time on that, you know, working out what the stage business is at different points and so on, because I think it's extremely clever, but it's very subtle sometimes. You can blink and miss, you know, an important bit.
Yes, I mean, that's sort of one of our jobs, is actually sorting out the options that each scenes are giving us and all of those questions, because we did detect, you know, certainly later on with the John's mistress sort of princess plotline, which sort of still happens, but it feels like they've cut a scene.
Yes, it does.
And that question of, do you interpolate a scene or do the dumb show or do you just quietly drop that subplot?
Yeah.
It feels like that after the first performance they quietly went, let's just drop that bit.
Yeah.
And some bits remained in the manuscript and then got caught in the printing. That's my personal feeling. Other opinions may vary.
Something I wondered about, actually, with both this and The Blind Beggar at Bethnal Green, is whether they had a terrible shortage of boy actors at this point. And you know, they just couldn't get anybody who could do the female role that was needed for that particular scene.
Yes.
Because both plays really don't have much for much in the way of women's roles. And I don't even know. I mean, Robin Hood is obviously played by a boy, and then Marion Falconbridge, and that's it, I think.
Yes, we've got the Queen pops in, but only very briefly.
That's right.
She has two good scenes, and they are good scenes. I mean, she's very forthright in the most delightful way.
And then there's Henry's wife, who has pretty well nothing to say.
Literally has one line.
Yes,
in French.
Yes,
mon bleu.
Yes, these must have been very young boys in the company, you know, being given a little bit of stage experience.
Yeah, I mean, it is odd. I mean, just talking about you know, the Robert having to be played by a boy, because Robert is, I say, this is more a prequel to Robin Hood in the sense that, you know, we have Robin, we have Marion, but Marion is married, and Robin is in theory trying to woo her on the behalf of Richard, soon to be Richard the First, and Robin has to cosplay as Marion to disguise himself, so he has to be a boy, it has to be that age, because then he can we can do the meta sort of thing of a boy actor playing a woman who's disguised as the other boy actor who's a woman, you know, and so there is something quite fun about that. It also asks interesting questions about Robin and Marion's later relations, which is quite fun.
There's also the fact that Lady Falconbridge, you know, in King John, tells her son, the bastard, that she did indeed succumb to Richard and that, you know, he is Richard Lionheart's son.
There might be a dribble.
No, that's okay, you keep it.
Yes, because you were saying earlier that, you know, that this is more almost the matrix of King John plays than it is. We've got the Troublesome Rain that plays with a lot of these themes, and some other play I can't think of. And we do have other texts that we haven't got around to looking at that deal with the Matilda Marion question as well. But yes, so Robin is in this play, and he's playing a relatively fun disguising role, but he's not the central role, and he's not very Robin Hood-y.
No, he's not. He's not robbing anybody, for one thing. I mean, Skink robs people, and even Gloucester robs people, though we haven't really gone into that. I mean, it's for a good purpose, and he usually gives everything back, as far as I can make out. I mean, there are various props that pass from hand to hand, and again, this is, it's quite tricky to follow this. It's tricky to follow the disguises. It's tricky to follow the moving props.
Yes, but I don't think we need to disguise too much of the business here about, you know, because there's a pardon, there's all sorts of little things that are going as the scenes progress. But the constant joke is always someone walks off, you know, stage, and then somebody else walks on from the other side of the stage dressed in their costume, and everyone miraculously thinks it's the other person, even though they know someone's wandering around in disguise. It's very farcical.
Yes, the one thing nobody ever says is, I wonder if that could be somebody in disguise.
Yes.
No, there's a lovely moment when two people disguised as hermits walk on together and each one is saying, I'm the real hermit. No, you aren't.
Yes, because the hermit's cave does feature quite prominently. It's introduced at the beginning, but then there's a point about halfway through the play where everyone goes, we must go and visit the hermit. And so, the hermit had more than one hermit costume. Both Gloucester and Skink are disguised as the hermit, and will the real hermit please stand up?
Yeah. And the hermit is incredibly well informed. I mean, everybody is dazzled by the breadth of his knowledge, because usually it's Skink saying, yes, Skink is the one that robbed you, and he also did this, and he also did this. Wow! How does he know all this?
Yes. Yes. And again, the using that foreseeing power to try and vaguely set up a resolution for their own character's thread as well, of going, you should do this, and this will be lovely. And then it leads, after all this delight, to this ending, which suddenly goes very dark. You say it was foreshadowed, but, you know, it was, when we read it, I missed it. So when we got to that, we're going to chop your hand off. Gloucester, who's been doing lots of likely naughty things, as well as slapping Skink in the presence of the kings, is put on trial. And we get a lengthy trial scene to close the play.
Yeah, so it's mainly because, Prince John particularly, and the young King Henry absolutely hate him. Richard, in fact, is quite sympathetic toward him, although that's partly because Richard is in love with his sister, who is Falconbridge's wife. I mean... and actually, another thing that's interesting is that Gloucester's first name is Robert, and he does occasionally refer to himself as Robin. So we've also got that sense, just as Falconbridge's name is Richard, and then there's Prince Richard. There's this funny doubling of characters, which is actually very confusing. And in a performance, we'd probably try to get rid of that. We've got this amazing scene where they suddenly say, yes, we've got to cut this guy's hand off on the stage, and they get all the props out, a basin and a towel and everything, and it really does look as if it's going to go through. And and Gloucester says, I can take it, come on, bring it on, you know. and his sister's saying, oh, how brave you are. And then everybody sort of shows their true colors at this point, except the young king, who has been holding back, or either that, or there's been a flash of lightning and he's changed his mind. At any rate, he finally says he's going to do it, and then he says, and thus, and then as he would wait for him to chop, instead he says, I embrace you, honored Earl, and and I'm going to give the crown back to my father, and I'm going to go off and lead a religious life, and I'm going to send my wife back to France. I think he calls her Little Tit of France.
Yes. Yes. Not desperately nice, yes. And yes, suddenly there's this conversion, and or it was a plan all along. Production can decide which way to go. But it's really meaty, actually. There's really dynamic stuff. And I say, changing up from the stuff we had earlier, the farce and the constant moving around, to them returning to that family dynamic, you know, the worst Christmas ever that we had at the beginning of the play. And I think it solves that problem of sometimes with these plays of, you know, how do you end it? You know, by presenting a slightly different scenario in a different situation. I think it does it really well.
And then they all suddenly turn into historical characters.
Yes.
And Richard says, you know, I'm going off to the Holy Land. And Gloucester says, I'm going off to Portugal and get rid of the Moors. And then Skink amazingly says, I'll go with you. I mean, they have already told Gloucester that it's up to him now to decide how to punish Skink. And Skink has even said, oh, well, that'll be okay then. He's honorable. But the idea of Gloucester and Skink marching off together, I'm pretty sure that must have happened in the sequel, because they're There was a later play, although unfortunately it's lost, about the humorous Earl of Gloucester and his conquest of Portugal. And there does seem to have been some legend about it, because it's also referred to in the Spanish tragedy, I think, when the stuff about all the English conquests in Spain and Portugal.
Yes, I mean, it's a slightly problematic ending for us. I'm just going, because it's this high point of, let's go and do some ethnic cleansing. It's great. It's all a bit awkward. I mean, in a sense, it's sort of fine for Richard to be going about, I'll go on crusade. Yeah. I mean, it's not fine. Cause it
Well, everybody knows he did it.
But everybody knows he did it, and it's sort of part of his narrative, whereas the others who are sort of going, well, we don't really care what you did next. So, there is that element of minor adjustments maybe there.
Yes. I think it would have to be kind of over the top, like so much else. I mean, I mean, I really do picture something like organ music behind Henry's announcement that he's going to go lead a pious life, and he sort of goes off stage, and maybe there's even a halo around his head.
Yes, the brightest light, you know, the doors open, and
that's the sort of thing. Yeah,
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And then if you have everybody else kind of, well, let's get in on the act, you know, what's the most pious thing we can think of?
So, sort of wandered through the play. Now, Gemini, we've already touched a bit on its the nature of the text that we've got, and how untidy it is. Is there any more that we can say about that we haven't already said? Have we covered everything? Has it had much of a modern publishing history, really? I'm trying to think of an edition for Look About You off the top of my head, because I don't think I've got one at home.
I know I've got the Malone Society one, which is extremely difficult to read. I mean, you really have to use your imagination, I mean, because there are very few stage directions. And
and the nature of the way they produce text is not user-friendly in that sense. It is very much for the specialist.
And the punctuation is really bad. I mean, there are places where it's totally misleading.
So in a sense, that question for us is very much of trying, how do we now tidy up? How far do we go in tidying up? How much do we infer or add to the scripts for future performances? And you know, when it comes to further down the line, when you know we make material like this available for other people, you know, what kind of stuff do we make available? It is not explicitly our job to, you know, produce, you know, a fully edited version in that sense. But you know, being able to produce an editable script, because this script needs to be editable. Because you have to do so much with it to get it right for a performance. There's a lot of workshopping to do with it, which shouldn't put you off, because it's really good.
It is. And it has been done. I mean, it's been done at Stanton, Virginia, very successfully. And there was an extremely good staged reading at the Wanamaker, directed by John Hopkins, who brought enough costumes. You know, they do these with basically no costumes, no props, no sets. But he did bring enough stuff that you could tell who was trying to be whom. He had a nice red coat for John, for example, and I think just sort of hats and, you know, various kinds of headgear. And it really did work. And I thought, you know, even the ending came off quite well. I mean, Gloucester was sympathetic and Skink was fun and, you know, you were interested in the whole story. I think everybody at the end of that was saying, why isn't this one ever done? This was wonderful.
Did they, I don't know if you'll know, but you were semi-involved with that, or were you?
Well, only in the sense that I wrote program notes and I gave some pre-performance talks. I didn't do one for that play. I did the two Monday plays and Edward the First, I think. But, you know, it was a whole season, including the Sad Shepherd.
I was just going to say, do you know how much editorial tweaking they did, or whether they cut any because it's not a short play.
No,
I mean,
it's not.
It runs fast, I think. So I don't think it's still quite long. I think it's about 26,000 words.
I don't think they cut anything. They don't normally. I think they made an exception in the case of Every Man Out of His Humour.
Everybody has to make an exception for Every Man Out of His Humour.
Quite. <yeah. laughs> But normally, Red Not Dead, I think, does do the full text because there isn't really time to do anything else. I mean, they do get you know, a reasonable sort of modernized edition of it. If there isn't one already, somebody does one. And I think they may insert stage directions if they think of it, but mostly it's up to the person organizing them. And of course, as you know, they start rehearsing at 10 on Sunday and they put it on at 4 that afternoon. So they basically go through everything once and they're told sort of where to enter and where to exit and They do sort of basic fights and dances.
Mm. Yeah. Is this one fight heavy? I don't know how much fighting there is. I think there's more brawling than fighting, isn't there?
Yes, there's fighting at the end. I mean, there's the fight between Richard and Gloucester, which seems to go on for some time. I mean, there are several places where they pause. And
Of course, yes.
Because, in fact, that is really where Gloucester is behaving like Robin Hood. I mean, he does do a sort of stand and deliver thing, and Richard says he's keeping the purse, and then at some point he says, I think he throws it down, and then Gloucester, they've been fighting, and then I think Gloucester says, well, actually, you can have half of it, and we'll call it a draw, and Richard says, no, I'm not going to encourage thieves, let's keep on fighting.
Yes,
it kind of goes on like that.
Because that's one of the main draws for Robin Hood, is that there'll be opportunities to have a fight scene. Mm. And, yeah, it's good that it's in there. I mean, we have, amongst our group, you know, at least several fighty people who are always... Their eyes always light up when it says, and they fight. Yeah, I mean, all of the Robin Hood plays. I mean, the one we haven't mentioned is Georgia Green, of course, which, again, Robin Hood is a more tangential figure. He's the older Robin Hood, in the sense we've got a prequel and we've got we've got a sort of end of life version where Robin Hood's looking over his shoulder, going, "Oh, I haven't got quite as many. I haven't got as many Instagram likes this at the moment. Yeah. Everyone's following Georgia Green, this new upstart guy, and he meets Georgia Green, and it's all this fanboy of going, 'Oh my God, you're Robin Hood! I love you!' And they have, but that's after they've had a fight, and that's another delightful one. All of these Robin Hood plays are just so wonderful and doable. I mean, this is the thing. So I do think these are, you know, commercially viable shows. You know, it's almost a thing. Don't mention it's an early modern play and see if anyone notices.
A season of, you know, Look About You, followed by the Monday play, at any rate, perhaps followed by Georgia Green. We leave out the... I don't know. Edward I is tricky because Robin Hood doesn't actually appear in it. There is a friar who is very like Friar Tuck, but isn't. He's Welsh anyway. At least I think he's Welsh. And the Prince of Wales, I mean, literally, I think he's known in history as Llywelyn the Last, because he was the last Welsh Prince of Wales, takes on the name of Robin Hood and lives in the Greenwood. But
yes.
But there is no actual Robin Hood in it, so you probably wouldn't do that one. But I think you could have rather a nice little trilogy, possibly condensed into two plays, since the Georgia Green thing is pretty short.
Well, and also to thinking, I'd say, if you're doing this as a semi-season, it's the kind of thing where if you're doing it somewhere where they've got a studio space, you could do a little mini Death of Robin Hood, you know, just that little bit, because it's sort of to finish it off. Yeah. But, you know, that would be a sort of much more, you know, one-off kind of thing, rather than the bigger, because this feels like a main house show. It feels like something you could actually shift several hundred tickets for if you sell it on the Robin Hood, you know, and fun fast thing, and you get a few decent reviews. It's got legs, you know, because a lot of the plays we do, we're going, how do we sell this? I don't know, we can't. And that's sort of our challenge for a lot of things, whereas this is much more a slam dunk of just going, it should, he said, touching wood, sell itself.
I mean, it's one of the funniest plays I know, really. But it's not only that, it's got a sort of heroic quality in it. I mean, Gloucester is mostly a kind of comic character. I mean, he says he likes jokes, and one of these crazy people who, whatever the situation is, suddenly sees a chance for a joke. But he is also sort of heroic, and both he and Skink are on the run during a great deal of the play, and then they're both caught at the same time, both dressed as hermits and brought to the court. I don't know, it just seems, you know, it's got both comedy and kind of excitement and fights, you know, pretty much everything. I don't think it has much in the way of music. I mean, there's a bit where Richard brings musicians to sing to Marian, and then Robin Hood comes out and tells them to go away, but they may still sing. I mean, it would be... I always think everything is improved by a song.
Well, if not, sung music, but certainly it feels like something where if you've got a band or you've got something, you know, because obviously you've got trumpeting for entrances and exits of kings, etc. I think there's... Because this kind of thing speaks to melodrama and that kind of playing style, so I think that works very nicely. Yeah, it's one of those that excites me very much. I think we've covered most of the things that I've got noted down here. And yes, we've covered sort of performance history. It has had a modern, you know, it has worked in front of human beings. Mm-hmm. And obviously, we've done our first look at it, and all the other Robin Hood-esque texts mm-hmm. are available on the YouTube channel. So you can always go and view any of that. And some of them we've done more than once. We've done Georgia Green twice, so we've mm-hmm. Got a decent second look at that, which we've done with actions, mm-hmm. and we've even done a special episode of the podcast on the fantasy production meetings. We've even talked about how that might be produced. Mm-hmm. And this might be a follow-up sometime further down the line. Mm-hmm. Any additional things about this that we've not mentioned?
Mm. I don't know. I mean, speaking of music, though, you could possibly use the Robin Hood ballads if you were doing the Monday. Not so much in this play, I think, but there are so many episodes in them that could be used kind of between scenes or something, just to remind people of the story. And besides, they have nice tunes and, you know, they just be pleasant to hear.
Mm, that's one thing we haven't really been doing enough of late is delving into the musical side of the early modern world, because there's an awful lot. Even if we don't necessarily have the music, we certainly have the words too. Mm. And yes, actually, just digging further into Robin Hood generally, we should do. Mm. So I'm going to sign off now. Thank you very much for joining me, and you can catch Lois on many episodes of the on the YouTube channel as a frequent guest and reader as we've continue our journey through the early modern and occasionally medieval world of or pre-modern drama, basically. So thank you very much.
Yes, well, thank you.
Many thanks to Lois Potter for sharing coffee biscuits and discussion on Look About You. You've been listening to the Beyond podcast. Follow us on Twitter at Beyond Shakes, support us on Patreon at patreon.com/Beyond Shakespeare, or buy us a coffee on ko-fi.com/Beyond Shakespeare and all that jazz. Till next time, I've been your host, Robert Crichton. Goodbye.